Welcome back to the Talking Physiotherapy Podcast. It's good to be back. You might have noticed that we've changed our name slightly and the logo slightly since the last episode, but we're still the same three people having the same sort of conversations about different relevant topics in physiotherapy. In today's episode, so episode 29, we're going to be talking about additional qualifications in sport. So we're going to be talking about things like ITMF, FISIS, and other extra qualifications that can help you get ahead before you start in work, and then once you're in the world of work as well, depending on what area of physiotherapy you're going to go into. So, guys, let's start it off. What do you want to speak about first?
Name change.
Go ahead.
Yeah. New ideas, I think. I think it was probably due for a little bit of an update. I think we've been going for a while, and obviously we've all qualified now. So I think that was probably the biggest part, that we're not students anymore. I think we still are going to target a lot of our content towards students and new grads, so there's not going to be that much of a change there. But I think it was time for just a bit of an update as we've kind of moved on as well. And yeah, hopefully some different types of content coming out as well. I don't know, Lewis, if you want to go into that.
Yeah, so we'll obviously keep the podcasts going once a month, and the plan is probably more so into the new year that we're going to start to roll out some sort of workshops or webinars targeting societies around the UK, physio societies around the UK, just providing content on topics from a perspective of a new graduate. And this idea has probably come about through our own feedback that we've given people who have hosted webinars over the years whenever we were at uni, just looking at things about how we would do different types of assessments, different types of rehab, how we would look at our own clinical pathways. We definitely felt that some of the courses that we were on maybe were a step above what a graduate or a student was looking for. So we're hoping that what we'll provide will bring that a little bit closer to home, help to kind of bridge that gap from what we learn at university to what we learn from the much more experienced guys in the field.
Perfect. So in terms of moving into the episode, so I think that explains quite nicely what the name change is and why we've done it. So to jump into the topic, so extra qualifications. So obviously, with myself working in sport, Brad working part-time in sport, and then Lewis working in sort of a sports medicine environment, we thought it'd be relevant to talk about extra qualifications and how those can help. So I think we said, lads, that we were going to split it up into your sort of virtual means of learning, your CPD side of things, and then your in-person stuff when you're more looking towards where you're employed, and then you're looking for qualifications that are appropriate for your sport. So in terms of that, Brad, what were the kind of virtual ones that you had found that were the helpful when you were studying?
Yeah, I think probably on quite a relevant topic at the moment is, and very easy to access, is the things that the RFU do through Headcase. So it's all about concussions and spotting concussions and managing concussions, and the RFU put loads of great resources, and you can take like a little course and you get a certificate at the end to prove that you've done some learning around concussions, and it doesn't take too long to do, so you could spend a couple of hours just going through all the different things and making sure you're up to date on it. And it's actually been changed recently, all the guidelines have been changed, and so now we're using like SCAT 6 at a lower level, so realistically it was NAT 2 and upwards, so now professionals at even lower levels are using SCAT 6, and it's allowing us to get people back. So having that awareness about it, I think it's really good to get it as a student, as it leads into being qualified. So definitely point you to the Headcase stuff from the RFU.
Lewis, was there anything that you found virtual-wise that matches more of a sports medicine route rather than your traditional sporting environment?
In terms of sort of sports trauma, not really to this point, to be perfectly honest. We don't really see anyone in the clinic where we are required to do sports trauma. We have actually had a conversation about doing sort of an advanced medical sports trauma course where we kind of host it just to kind of upskill ourselves on it. I think if anything, it's probably good to have the knowledge of it, even though you're maybe not applying it clinically day to day, having an awareness of what is happening pitch side for when guys are coming into the clinic with injuries. You kind of know the steps that have went on sort of in the previous 48 or 36 hours before they've come in to see you. So from actual courses that I've done, nil, but in terms of sort of having that conversation about how we can incorporate that into practice, yeah, we've kind of started talking about that.
And even if it wasn't sports trauma, was perhaps any other courses, I think one that you mentioned was the EXOS, that that was might be a good one to talk about, bearing in mind obviously this is one when you've graduated.
Yeah, so EXOS is like a sports performance program. So we kind of agreed for me that I would enroll in it after Christmas. But what we're kind of implementing now is that a lot of the key practices that EXOS deliver, that I would be sort of taught that in my supervision, so that when it came to me actually doing the course, I'd have a much better idea on what's going on with it. So yeah, things that the EXOS course provide are probably the intricate details that I would argue go beyond physio, and definitely tap into more of the performance side of coaching and looking at how you coach, techniques to coach and how you cue, looking at the nuances of biomechanical movements and how that can feed into sort of end stage rehab or sort of higher level performance within that kind of sports environment. So like if I was to give you an example, a lot of the stuff that we do with returning to run is we would do a phase of prep to run, which is taken out of the EXOS program. So that's looking at kind of how do you phase an athlete back into actual proper running. So we're running that 70% or running that at tempo pace. So that will be going through perfecting movements around skipping and A skips and B skips and dribbles and scissoring and things like that there. And doing that sort of in a linear direction, and then sort of how you incorporate change of direction into it and horizontal forces and lateral forces. And it's probably looking at movement in a slightly different way to how you're taught at uni, definitely. I also don't think it's a course that's for everyone. I think it's very specific to the environment that you're working in. If you're in an environment where you're maybe limited by rehab facilities and resources, I don't think it's probably the course for you. I think you definitely need, one, the space that you can deliver it, and two, the equipment that you can implement it. But yeah, very much looking forward to getting my teeth stuck into that after Christmas. In terms of other courses that we like to run that are sort of sports medicine-y, if you like, we don't really go after courses as much. We like to bring in the expert in the field to deliver some sort of program. So thinking of the last couple of years, we've had Colin Griffin deliver a presentation on his Achilles tendinopathy return to sport protocol that he published there a couple months ago as part of his PhD. We've had Ben Ashworth in for going through the ASH testing and implementing the ASH testing into practice. Alex Natera's come over going through his isometrics, and then yeah, there was another one recently. But yeah, probably more looking at experts in the field, current up-to-date research that they're doing, because I think that's a much more insightful conversation than going through a course with a certificate at the end of it, maybe. Mm.
Yeah, I think that's quite relevant what you said at the end there. I've definitely noticed that from the ones that I've done, so whether they'd be virtual or in person, that you get a lot more out of the in-person ones. You just naturally, well, for me, I naturally pick it up and you absorb the information better. So having an expert in front of you and going through things practically and theory wise, you're always going to retain more of it. And to dive into that a little bit more. So football specific ones that I think of great value. So, and I guess it all comes down to this, the point that we've made in previous episodes of the value of seeking extra qualifications when you're at uni. If you can manage it, benefits you greatly in the long run to give you extra bits that are tailoring you towards where you want to go. The FA is obviously a really good website for trainings and courses and things like that. So they have one on concussion. I think they have one on, well, they definitely do. They have one on safeguarding. There's another one called Paul Stewart, Safeguarding in Sport. Really, really good one on there. And these are, most of these are all free as well, which is probably worth me saying. If, you know, if you are a student, I know that, you know, money is normally a little bit tight. So it's good to have free opportunities to learn extra things. And then I think, Brad, did you mention the head case?
Yeah, yeah. I think that was the rugby one that's probably the biggest one to hit as a student.
Yeah, and there's many more as well. And I think the other thing we mentioned was conferences. So if you can ever get to an in-person conference, that's similar to what Lewis was saying there with the experts in the field, if you like, and they'll have the up-to-date research. It's not always going to be exposing you just to their stuff, but they will normally talk about the other experts in the field as well, which is a brilliant way of perhaps getting a feel for the research and what's out there without having to be on a database typing and reading away.
I think on that point, so I've just been to the NCOR conference, and when you've got people like Joe Gibson and Mehmet Cem, like absolute experts in their field, talking about how they go through assessments and what rehab is to them and what little tips and tricks they've got for dealing with complex patients or a certain type of patient, and you don't actually ever really get taught that as much. Like when you're at university, there's somebody saying, oh, this is the science behind it, now you need to like learn how to apply it yourself, but they don't actually give you like the expert's context and, oh, when I have this sort of patient, this is what I do. You don't have the opportunity to ask the questions that you're interested in. And I think that human touch is really, really valuable. And getting that information as a student, I think, like the one that I just went to has got had loads of value as a band 5, but if I'd done that as a student, I think I'd be quite far ahead, because you're already having those conversations. It's just anecdotal things. Like a mistake students often make is giving loads of exercises out, and you're giving like 6 to 10 exercises. But reality in the NHS, we're talking 2 or 3 that your patients will actually do. And when you hear the experts actually saying that and saying, I give one exercise out, 2 exercises out, and my patients get better, you realise you don't actually need to overwhelm them with all these great ideas. And it's just hearing that from someone at the top of the field, it's like, okay, actually, maybe this is a way to work.
I think something like that gives you a lot more confidence as a graduate that what you're actually doing probably isn't too far wrong, because you kind of, like, I've spoken about this during my supervision, and like, you can go through a cycle, if you like, you know, you're on placement and you're like, right, just do the basics well, you know, don't try and do anything fancy, you know, make it very simple for yourself. And then you graduate and you're like, okay, I'm a physio, I can do all the complicated stuff now. And then you realize that actually doesn't really work as effectively as just giving out the basics and getting them to nail the basics. And like you said, I think it definitely takes something humanistic to really achieve the value in that. Like, most of these experts sell a masterclass course online, and I'm not dissing anything, because they are brilliant, but nothing will ever beat being in the same room with them and asking them questions and giving them an example of what you've seen and getting their opinion of that and how what they're talking about and how their research actually fits into what you're doing on a day-to-day. I think that's the invaluable component to it.
Cool.
Do we want to speak about that? Should we move on to the sports trauma?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, considering that I haven't done any sports trauma, I'll ask the questions. Right. So, taking that you are two very different, two similar but very different sports, just before we started recording here, we were trying to work out the nuances of it. So, Brad, do you want to go through the qualification that you've got to work at the level that you're at, and then we'll give a brief comparison with Connor
Yeah, so I did the Physis level 2. There is a level 3 as well. And it's for Rugby Union. And the level I'm at is National 3. So it's kind of like 4th division down, sort of like Football's League 2. And at that level, you don't actually need to have one of these qualifications. It's desirable, but it's not a necessity, as long as you've got some sort of first aid or, and you're actually qualified, obviously. But we got the level 2 just to make sure that we are quite switched on with it. The level 3 is kind of the more advanced thing. So in your level 2, you're looking at your general pre-hospital care. Then it kind of... Your level 3, you're taking it up to sort of your advanced technique, sort of your needle decompression, managing pneumothoraxes, so the more advanced stuff, which you do need in like the elite level. But for most people coming out of university, that's probably a step too far too quickly. You probably get yourself a little bit confused trying to learn everything at once if you haven't previously done any sports trauma. Yeah, and then if we want to compare it to the other rugby one, so they've got IMOF. So that's Rugby League's qualification. Don't know too much about that or what levels they've got. But yeah, if I think at the level I work at, you could have sort of any of them qualifications and you pass. But when you start to get into the top levels, the elite sport, you kind of need to go that specific route for the course that your sport delivers.
And then kind of comparing that to you, what sort of qualifications do you have for the level that you're currently working at then?
Yeah, so at the moment I currently hold an ITMIF, which is level 4 in the football FA qualifications. So in terms of your football and your leagues and things like that, you would probably be fine at pretty much all levels below, say, a championship with an ITMIF. Being in the Premier League obviously changes quite a lot, and the rules and regulations and things will go up. Your ITMIF is... Just as Brad said with his, it's a pre-hospital care qualification, trauma qualification. So it's level 4. There are only 5 levels. So there's only ATMIF, which is above it. And ITMIF is in the region of about £500-600. The ATMIF is level 5, which is about £700-800. Typically, if you are, for example, considering doing a part-time role at a football club, they will put you on an ITMIF course, and that would be plenty for what you need. If you are someone who is working in a first team environment or progressing to that, so a development squad or as such, an ATMIF would normally be required, especially with being involved sort of Premier League competitions and cup competitions and things like that. It would be difficult for me to speak with some complete confidence about the exact types of games that need the exact types of qualifications. However, as a general rule, that's probably it. In terms of differences between the ITMIF and the ATMIF, not a massive deal. Obviously, you've got your medications, and ATMIF is more of it's advanced, so it's more of your management of a situation, given all of the equipment to deal with it. And the ITMIF is more of the down on your hands and knees, kind of getting dirty, dealing with the situation yourself. As I understand. In terms of the process, all of these sports trauma qualifications typically have their acronym for dealing with a situation. So, for example, we were taught for the ITMIF Dr. A to E, so Dr. A, B, C, D, E. So you'd be working through, you know, danger is the initial thing to make sure that you're not going to get hurt dealing with someone else. Response, so, you know, ascertaining are they alert, verbal, pain or unresponsive. And then working through, you know, what's their airway like, what's the breathing like, what's their circulation like, what's, you know, do they have any disabilities or anything like that, and then the other one, so exposure. And obviously there's a lot more detail in it, but go on, Lewis, I think you're going to say something.
No, I was just going to say something that cropped into my head there. So both of you have obviously, you do the qualification, which is a separate day out of work, so to speak. With you being full-time in that environment, Connor, do you have a setup as a team in terms of updating that throughout the year, or going through trauma management strategies throughout the year, how that changes from a home game to an away game? And then I suppose jumping that onto Brad, then with you working in it part-time, what's the consensus as a team updating or going through that throughout the year, just making sure that everyone stays on top of it?
Yeah, so in terms of the qualifications itself, it expires after 3 years. So the first thing is making sure it's in date. Next thing, in terms of being a full-time member of staff, obviously you'd need to be aware of the emergency action plan for the pitch, whichever pitches you're involved with. So obviously you would have the equipment. So you'd have your green bag, which would have your oxygen, your painkillers and your airways. And then you'd have two orange bags, which would typically have crutches, frac packs, spinal collars, things like pelvic binders, etc. And then you'd always have a defib. And that's sort of the equipment that you've got. And then the EAP, you would obviously need to know where the closest hospitals are for what type of injury. And then you would need to know the route to get from the pitch to the emergency room that you're going to perhaps deal with or monitor them in, and or the ambulance, and then an entrance and an exit for the ambulance. And then knowing who else is on site and what qualifications they hold to be able to potentially help you with the situation. In terms of how that differs for an away fixture, not a great deal, other than that you don't need to have all of that knowledge because it's not your site. So you would just need to know what qualification you hold, obviously, make sure that you've got the appropriate equipment, and then you would run through an EAP before kickoff, hopefully minimum of sort of an hour before kickoff, and they would explain how their process works. I think that answers all of what you said.
Yeah.
How's that different for you, Brad?
Yeah, I think similar, but obviously you're at a more elite level, even if it's at academy. And I think probably especially with academy, if you're looking after children, you kind of need to make sure that children are safe. At the community level, where obviously sometimes we're alone working, there'll be the other team physio, but we might be the only person in the building. So we might not have necessarily as much of a team around us. If we're at home, obviously we've got our own, like you said, kind of the frac packs. We don't have a doctor associated with the club, so we can't have oxygen, and we can't have any like prescription medication. So to us, that's more of either an ambulance call or we're sending somebody to A&E. Obviously, you still need the emergency action plan, and we've got that, and we'll explain that to the other team when they come. DFib, that's a community one, so it's a call 999 and get the information. So a lot of this stuff we might not have necessarily with us, but we've got it available. I think in terms of the planning, obviously we've all gone on this course and we're aware of that, but we do like CPD days. So just kind of, if it's a quiet night in the training or something, we'll get the equipment out, we'll run through it. We've run through it with some of the coaches. So if we need to extricate someone and we need quite a few people to bring them off, obviously mm-hmm. if there's only us, we need some other people to be aware of what's going on just to make our lives a little bit easier. And I mean, you could train them on the day, but you're more likely to have success if there's other people that are aware of how the extrication is going to take place. So yeah, I think similar, but almost in the community setting, you need to adapt a little bit more and you might not have everything straight away. Go on, sorry.
Something that I forgot to speak about was obviously the method of extrication. The thing that you're going to use to help you with that obviously would be a scoop.
Yeah.
So obviously the gold standard is your split scoop, and then you obviously take them into a rigid spinal board. You'd scoop them into that and then take them from there. So that's another piece of equipment that you would be getting taught how to use on the courses. Yeah. But then also, you know, it adds to the other equipment that you're taking to the event. And obviously if you're at home, if you're at the home venue, you would be responsible for knowing where that is and how to use it. And then obviously the opposition's it would be theirs. In terms of the reviews, so as a club, we periodically review our EAP and then also run through it happening. So for example, someone goes down, how can we get them from Fervis Corner to the physio room? Every club should go over it periodically so that all staff are aware, so that you can ensure that it is practically possible, that people know how to do it. Because it's one thing having a plan and then another thing actually doing, you know, actioning on that plan, and silly things like only realizing that a double door, one opens but the other one, the lock slightly jammed, so that actually you wouldn't be able to get a scoop in the door because six people can't squeeze themselves through one gap.
Yeah,
so that's the reason behind actually carrying it out in practice.
Actually running it through.
Yeah. Very good. Has anyone anything else they want to raise?
I think just one thing I did forget to say was prices that Connor mentioned earlier. So for the level two, I think it's about £360, and the level three is £720, so double the price. And the Physis level two is a 1-day course, usually held at a rugby club. Go there and do your full day. You have a written exam and a practical exam on the day, and then you've passed. The level three is a 2-day course, so the Saturday and the Sunday. Similar sort of thing. Kind of do your theory and your other stuff. And then the second day, your exams. I think one thing we probably didn't mention, Connor, was like pre-reading and learning.
Yeah.
Like, there was a significant amount of that before we even started. So I think what was good about the fight, so we had like 20 hours, maybe 30 hours of pre-learning beforehand. All this, like, you have to do the reading and then you do a quiz. You have to have full marks on the quiz before you can actually attend on the day. And then when you do it, you should know everything. You should know what's going on. They don't even present any presentations. It's all like speaking to you and practical stuff. It's all like getting yourself in there. So you should go with full knowledge. And then it's just compounding that.
So it's nearly like a bit like what Connor's saying there about the reviewing it. It's almost like doing it in reverse. So it's like you're going in with the theory, with the idea of just showing the practical that you're actually competent in doing it. That, not that they don't care, but that they don't really, they expect you to have a certain level of baseline going into it.
Definitely. It's the expectation. I think you can't get the most out of it. It's similar to university learning, but I mean, it's very important when it's a practical course and they don't need to be teaching you things. They just need to be showing you the actual equipment and making sure that you're competent with what you're doing it. Because if you're not, then if you're going in just not knowing anything, you're really going to struggle on the day. You're probably not going to pass the written exam, and you're going to probably be quite nervous for the exam, trying to do everything on one day, because at the end of the day, it is a lot of information. I think that's probably, we had a whole university module on it, guys, so I think it does show that there is a lot to cover. And if you went into that without preparation, I think you'd be asking a lot of yourself, really. I think that's why they have the pre-learning there.
In terms of the location and the prep for ITMF, very, very similar to what Brad said. So obviously you have an online portal, there's lots of stuff to read through, then you do a quiz, and they don't let you on until you've got a certain mark in that quiz. So I think the other thing as well, speaking about it, and obviously if you don't have a lot of knowledge of this prior, is to say that it isn't as daunting as it might sound. It might, you know, if it's something that you think, that you're thinking, oh, that's putting me off, if it's doable, don't get me wrong. Otherwise no one would ever pass it. It's just literally like Brad says, if you make sure that you do the prep work going into it, there shouldn't be any surprises. It's all written down. They're telling you what's going to be on the day. So, and then in terms of the location for the ITMF, it's typically held at St George's Park, and it's a 2-day course. And then occasionally it can be held at clubs. So you might find that in your scenario that the club is paying for the course providers to come to the club, and then they do it there with all the equipment. But I think that's a more of a rare occasion. So yeah, very, very similar between football and rugby. And I would imagine even in rugby league or at the sports drama qualification will work in a similar way. You know, it's that practical base to get that locked in, then be prepared for your practical base to get your hands, you know, get stuck in and get used to things.
Perfect. That kind of to round us up on that.
Yeah, I have nothing further.
Okay then, so thank you for listening to episode 29 of the Talking Physio podcast, and it's also the kind of the first under the new name. So thank you for tuning in. As always, get in touch with us if you have any feedback, and bye for now.